Director Anderson.
Yes, here today. I, as usual, have a variety of topics to go over with you this morning, and I have a few handouts as I go along that will pertain to several of the topics that I will speak to. The first I'm going to go through is our legislative report, and have a handout for that. And I'll go through and hit some of the high points. So we're well into the 2013 legislative session. We've got our first cutoff, which is today on February 7th. It's the policy cutoff, so it's the last day to read into committee reports in the House of Origin, except for our House Fiscal Committees and our Senate Ways and Means and Transportation Committees. We'll have another cutoff here in a few days on February 11th, last day for the House Fiscal Committees and the Senate Ways and Means and Transportation Committees relative to the bills that are in the House of the Origin. One of our key pieces of legislative efforts this year is our aquatic invasive species legislation. You can see that we have two bills, one in the Senate Substitute Senate Bill 6040, with prime sponsor of Senator Honeyford, and over on the House side, Substitute House Bill 2458, with Representative McEwen as our prime on that piece of legislation. Both bills were amended to include a 10% redirect of the watercraft excise tax, which is approximately $1.4 million, payable at the time of vessel registration, from the General Fund for Aquatic Invasive Species Management and Enforcement Activities. And before I conclude this particular item, I'll talk a little bit about some of the financial issues that the legislature is facing that make that part of that bill somewhat problematic for this year. Hunter education, again, we have bills over on the Senate side and the House side. When the Senate took action at the committee level, they reduced the registration fee from $20 to $10. There's challenges with trying to amend that back to the $20. In either the Senate Ways and Means or on the Senate floor. So we're going to continue to work that on the House side. It does remain intact over on the House side with all of the components, including the $20 fee, the minimum age of 8 years old to enroll in a hunter education class, the requirement that if 14 is the minimum age that you could hunt unaccompanied on public property. So if you're on private property, is not required in the bill. We did get a bit of a surprise just this week from Representative Taylor, who brought forward an amendment that would exempt anyone 21 years old or older from taking hunter education. And so right now, the way the law is structured, if you were born before 1972, you're required to take it. So that would be obviously a big change to the current statute in terms of who's required to take hunter education. More work to be done there. We've also had the issue that's associated with requiring live fire as part of the curriculum. We've been talking to Senator Roach, who's been particularly interested in that issue. So has Senator Pearson. Sorry. We do have what we think is a reasonable way to address that issue, and that is to leave it up to the particular instructor as to whether they want to have that part of their curriculum. Of course, the issue there is if you have your class in an area where you don't have a range to have that part of your class that's a reasonable distance from where the class is being held, that having that as a requirement can be an encumbrance on that particular class, so wanting to give some latitude there. And, of course, if you take the class on the web, then you don't have to have live fire, so we're trying to get some balance there. I think I'm going to need two of them. So I think we've got a good solution to that issue. You're also aware that we've got an enforcement omnibus bill. It's doing well on both houses and moving along without any amendments. We've also got a fish passage barrier removal piece of legislation that we're finding a lot of support for. You'll see under the House bill the key components of that: creates fish barrier removal board that's chaired by DFW, includes members of local governments, Department of Transportation, tribes, Governor Salmon Recovery Office, and DNR. This is one of the reasons this is getting such good support, particularly from local jurisdictions, is because of the culvert case, the requirement of the state to remove those barriers. I think the local jurisdictions see their exposure to the potential of that moving into their jurisdictions real, and so wanting to get out in front of that, and maybe in doing so preempting a legal challenge. You can see there's some other bills that we've listed there of interest. The pilot cougar program is back again. We've had conversations with several different counties, Stevens County in particular, on cougar removals. I think the chances of that bill moving forward are not good. We've also had focus on our forage fish from Senator Rolfes. We've been working with her. We've got an amendment to her bill that makes it a bill that we can live with. There was some in the original language. She was suggesting that we do population surveys on all forage fish species and quantify the populations of those forage fish species, and that we do that within our existing resources. The fiscal note on that was going to be in the millions of dollars. So I've had a good conversation with Senator Rolfes, took her some of the information in terms of how we're managing forage fish, and that led to this amendment. So I think we're going to have a good bill there. But I do certainly appreciate her focus on forage fish, the importance of that component of our ecosystem. Also got the wildlife conflict funding bill that's being sponsored by prime sponsor is Representative Blake. We've also have one on from Senator Parlett. It's a property tax on game lands. It requires the state treasurer, on behalf of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, to distribute game lands in each county a certain amount of lieu of real property taxes. So you may recall that how we go about paying that PILT for the Department of Fish and Wildlife is different than what they do for Department of Natural Resources, where it comes right out of the Treasury, whereas for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, it's an amount of money comes to us, and then we distribute it. It's been frozen at the 2009 level, which has put us in a position of not being able to fully meet our PILT payment requirements to the counties, and so this is an effort to address that. Similarly, Senator Schessler also has one. You may be aware that under the current statute, that tracts of 100 acres or less that we're not required to pay PILT on, Senator Schessler has the Senate Substitute Bill 6446, which would have us paying PILT on all of the land we have, regardless of the size of the parcel. We've done an analysis of what that means from a fiscal perspective, and it's relatively small, quite small, like I believe the number's like $5,000. So it's it doesn't represent an encumbrance that we don't think we'll be able to meet. The other bill having to do with lands comes from Senator Honeyford, and it's quite onerous, to say the least. Number one, requires agencies to submit a notification to the House and Senate committees, OFM, RCO, prior to acquiring real property for wildlife habitat or recreation. At the time of the capital budget submittal, acquisitions, agencies must identify non-state general fund sources to cover PILT, which, of course, is difficult to do. It requires agencies to submit a post-acquisition report summarizing the actual use of the property, results of monitoring, actual operation and maintenance costs, and the actual cost for PILT. And then finally, it says, the agency shall dispose of any property within 1 year if the pre-acquisition or post-acquisition requirements are not met. So a lot of interest in the lands issue in the legislature this year.
Okay. Commissioner Smith has a question.
Thank you. On the Taylor Amendment on Hunter Ed, did that kind of come out of the blue? Does that have a lot of support to make it only for under 21, or is that just...
It's, Commissioner Smith, that just surfaced, I believe, yesterday or Wednesday night. So we did not have any conversation about that with Representative Taylor, so it came as a surprise. To the degree that it has support, it's too early for me to ascertain that.
Yeah, I think it personally would be a shame to lower it.
Commissioner Smith.
Sure, on the same Hunter Ed, different topic, though. On the live fire, who actually funds the ammunition? I know that some of our Hunter Ed instructors have had to take the money out of their own pocket to get that done in recent years. Is that actually the case, or does the department fund for the live fire exercise?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't. At the present time, there's no fee for taking the course. I have no doubt that certain hunter education instructors have provided ammunition for live fire. There hasn't been in the past some protocols around caliber of weapon that would be used during the live fire. There hasn't been protocols around bringing their own guns as opposed to the guns that are provided for the class. So that's part of the policy changes that were made during the review of the hunter education policy. I believe that if this bill were to pass, there would be finite calibers that would be used for the live fire. 22s would probably be a common caliber that would be used for that. And this would provide funds for the purchase of the ammunition. But what has happened up to this point in time, I don't know that off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kehoe is next.
Yeah, thanks. Director Anderson, I have a questions about two bills, one that's on this list and one that's not on the list. But substitute bill 6072, the forage fish biennial report, my understanding is that the department testified at the hearing on the original bill and had mentioned something that there would be a huge or a large cost to comply with that, along the lines of, I think I heard $3 million. Is that accurate?
I believe it was 3.4.
Okay. And so you mentioned that you spoke with Senator Rolfes about amending the bill. And so did the amended version, what would the cost then be to the department to comply with that, if anything?
As amended, we would be able to comply with the requirements of the bill without any additional costs, or we would be able to absorb it within our existing staff to provide those reports back to the legislature. It's something that we're doing anyway, so we might have to package it a little bit differently. But we, you know, from sardines to herring to smelt, or the and any surveys that we're doing on sand lands, those kinds of things, we would be able to do with existing resources. So we don't have a, I don't know that it's zero, but it's close to it.
Okay. And then there's another bill. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's the derelict vessel bill that is in the House. And the bill primarily deals with the problem of derelict vessels, you know, what to do, how to prevent these things from occurring in Washington waters, and then also talking about you know, revenue sources for DNR for cleanup of these. There is a provision in the bill, and I'm not sure if you're aware of it, though, that talks about restrictions on the ability of commercial vessels to anchor anywhere on aquatic lands without permission or approval, written express approval from DNR. And I'm just curious whether the department is aware of that, and then secondly, if you are, and what effect that would have, as I'm sure you know, on the commercial fishing industry in Washington.
Commissioner Kehoe, I was not aware of that provision in that particular piece of legislation. I wouldn't say that our legislative liaison isn't aware of it, but I was not until you said that.
Okay, thanks. Well, maybe we can talk. It's very concerning to me. I don't understand it. But anyway, okay. I'm glad.
I'll pay some attention to that.
Commissioner Mencken.
Regards fish passage, as long as we're talking about fish passage barriers, we heard from Robert Deshiel from Bainbridge Island that there's a concern about the type of culverts that are presently being proposed by the city. Do you know what the difference in terms of the requirements for a fish passage barrier versus a flood control culvert rather than a flood control culvert?
I'm not sure that there would be a difference, but I don't, you know, I'd have to get our HPA folks to answer that with certainty. I mean, if it's in a fish-bearing stream, the culvert specifications or bridge specifications would be, I don't believe there's a difference between the two.
There seems to be a difference in the cost of the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about this later. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
And I think the relevant point for us that he was making, too, was that this was a stream in which there was no evidence that there was fish presence. And I know that that's going to be a theme that we hear over and over again. So do you happen to know whether the culvert case led to a result? We have to provide fish passage in all streams that could potentially support fish, or is it fish evidence of fish presence have to be present? Is it based on stream flow?
To the best
criteria?
Of my knowledge, whether there are fish below the barrier, whether that enters into the equation of whether that barrier has to be removed or not, I'm not certain. There are believe there's 837 barriers that DOT has to remove. We had barriers on our properties, as did state parks. But whether presence, absence of fish below the barrier went into whether or not the barrier needed to be removed, I'm not sure.
Interesting question. Any other? Oh, I did also see a bill recently, I think, dropped that would create an advisory committee, another advisory committee to the commission, and this one would address the interests of small-scale prospectors. Were you aware of that?
I was aware of it. I haven't read the bill, but I was aware of it.
Do you know who the sponsor is? Oh, I think we did.
Senator Pearson.
Senator Pearson. Okay. I think we haven't reached a conclusion about whether we will support or not.
Tammy is, I could read lips, I'd be ahead. Rather than me try to do this on the fly, let me take a look at the bill analysis here, and we can talk about that.
Okay. Thanks. All right.
Okay. Wanted to, before I leave the legislative arena, just wanted to talk a little bit about our supplemental budget requests. I've had an opportunity to meet with several different key legislators on this matter, this week there was some additional funding shortfalls identified during the legislative budget process, which puts considerable doubt over whether supplemental budget requests of general fund revenue are going to be funded. And we had 14 different categories in our budget request for the supplemental budget request, not all of which were looking for general fund, but certainly some of them were. So some of those I think are at one time may have had some potential for success, and I think given discussions this week, they have less potential for success. We're hoping that we can be successful with such things as the general fund request for the increase in fish food costs, the general fund request to offset our fire suppression costs this past summer. There are some of those types of categories which I think still have some hope of getting some assistance, but there are some others that are contract management system, our Vancouver region office relocation, which is actually a wildlife account request, but we need authority. So there are a few items on here which I think we had some hope that we might get funded through the supplemental budget process, but our hopes for that are growing dimmer by the day. Sticking with the theme of revenue, wanted to give you an update on our most recent revenue forecasts. You've seen this handout before. I'll just highlight a few of the numbers that are on here. Got it. So our total revenue collections through December 13th are about $24,619,000, which is $1.7 million higher than the same period in FY13. Both strong angling, moderate increases in hunting participation are translating to higher than forecasted revenue for our state wildlife account. The revenue from fishing license sales through December 13th is up about 15.4% over the same period last fiscal year. Overall, December fishing revenue came in at a little bit lower than forecasted. And as a reminder, our winter fisheries typically have little influence to our overall revenue, contributing less than 3% of the increase to fishing revenue over the next 2 months. Hunting revenue, our participation was up by a little over 1,400 individuals. 986 of those are individuals that are brand new to hunting, or at least in this state, and the balance are 474 are returning customers. The increase in participation is virtually equal between the two age groups of 11 to 20 and 21 to 30, and in this same age group, there has been an approximate 12% increase in female hunters. This is the first increase in hunter participation we've seen since 2008. So I know we saw some numbers, I think, here in the January meeting where nationwide there's been some increase in hunting participation. So we're seeing that here too. And lastly, just the Discover Pass sales continue to remain pretty strong, and they continue to show some growth, about 12% over the same period in FY13. Discover Pass sales are approximately 9% higher than this time last fiscal year's within WDFW. So the number of Discover Passes that are being purchased online through our wild system are up about 9%. So there's a lot more detailed information there that you've seen before. If you have any questions about them, feel free to catch up to me and we'll talk about those.
Director Henderson, the problem with shellfish sales to China and the impact on the ALEA account, do you have a general picture of that?
I don't know. I talked with Commissioner Goldmark about that 2 weeks ago. I think the problem was addressed and resolved in a timely way that we don't see a big hit on the ALEA fund. But that's what his initial thoughts were. Switching gears, so you may have seen that we have smelt or ulicon opener in the Columbia River. And I just wanted to, obviously you're aware that they're listed under the Endangered Species Act back in 2010, and wanted to just talk a little bit about that. So both states of Washington and Oregon are opening a limited ulicon fishery in the main stem and selected tributaries of the Lower Columbia River. And the harvest level represents an approximately 1% exploitation rate on the total run. A couple of the reasons that NOAA, as well as both departments from Oregon and Washington, want to do this is, one is that it's going to provide us some essential contacts for interpreting the historical data to better understand trends and variability in the population. It's going to fill some critical information gaps, such as the length of age, structure of spawning ulicon, as well as the temporal and spatial distribution of the run. In the past 3 years, so 2010 through 13, ulicon abundance has ranged in the median between 39 million and 110 million spawners in the Columbia River. For comparison, ulicon abundance in the Fraser ranged between 679,000 and 2.6 million. So we've seen a really strong return of Ulacon in the Columbia River. We'll have to see if that trend holds for subsequent years, but some pretty positive things from the Ulacon perspective. Our groundbreaking ceremony for the Voights Creek Hatchery is tomorrow up at the site at Voights Creek. Pretty exciting to think about building a new hatchery. It comes at a cost of about $17.4 million, and it's going to replace that existing hatchery that's pretty much been wiped out by floods on several different occasions. December of 07 was one of them, and again in 09. We're expecting the construction to be completed in June of 2015. We're going to be releasing fish not only from that facility into the Carbon River, but also from that facility in the Puyallup River. There's about 1.6 million fall Chinook and another 780,000 coho that will be released in the Carbon, and then another 400,000 fall Chinook and 100,000 coho that will go and be released out of the Puyallup hatchery. So some pretty significant production, and obviously where the Puyallup River is located, those fish come through a pretty good gauntlet of fishing opportunities, starting out in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. The contract was awarded to Rotchke, which is a company down in Vancouver, Washington, and the design and construction will be overseen by our Capital Assets and Management Program. $14 million of that 17.4 came from general obligation bonds through the Jobs Now Act in 2012, and then the balance, the $3.4 million, came from FEMA funds for damages caused in the 09 flood. So a couple of different sources there. So I'll be traveling up there and doing the groundbreaking ceremony. We've got some local officials from the county attending. I think Billy Frank is scheduled to be there along with the Puyallup tribe officials, so looking forward to that.
Dr. Anderson, is that in a location that the new hatchery would be in, a location that could serve the community in the way that we're seeing communities interested, embracing hatcheries as centers of learning and...
Well, we know we've had a lot of interest in the Puyallup hatchery from the local community, and I'm certain we'll have similar interest from the local community for Voights Creek. Mm-hmm. We have a pretty significant footprint in terms of piece of property. The hatchery is going to occupy, I'm going to guess, 20% or so of the piece of property that we acquired to put the facility on, so there are opportunities there for that kind of expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So. Okay, Tammy. I told you in January that we're putting some renewed effort into our sports show and other opportunities to try to promote outdoor recreation. So this week kind of marks our halfway point in our 2014 schedule. We've participated in Tri-Cities and Puyallup last month. This week we're in Portland. We'll also be in Yakima here in February, Wenatchee, and Spokane toward the third week of March. What you have there is our 6x10-foot banner that's seen at all of our sport show booths. Have that same. We've really tried to standardize, not totally lose the regional aspects of the sport shows depending on where they are, but also to kind of make some standardizations as to what the public has seen from us, where that makes sense. We've got a new set of handouts on topics of interest to both hunters and anglers, including hunter education, private lands access, and how to identify the different species of salmon. We've also improved our video display. got plenty of Fish Washington decals out there, and we're trying to turn every bumper and tackle box into an advertisement for our products. We've also been doing some additional work on vacation and tourism promotions, and that's that second piece that you have, the new Great Gateways website. We recently launched that to promote fishing vacations across the state and increase traffic on our popular Fish Washington web pages. You can see there's 14 vacation write-ups with links to a wide range of local and regional tourism information. Lots of positive news and feature coverage, but we're especially pleased about the response of from their visitor and tourist bureaus whose local vacation opportunities are mentioned on our website. And then for the first time, we plan to place a Fish Washington advertisement in the Washington State Visitor's Guide this year. Of course, you all know that it's a state's official vacation planner, so we're going to have some visibility there. We're also working with several other state agencies and businesses, nonprofit groups, to highlight the economic impact of outdoor recreation throughout Washington State. And the main event next Tuesday with respect to the Big Tent Outdoor Coalition is scheduled for 11 a.m. at the Rotunda in the Natural Resources Building. Got Governor Inslee coming over, several legislators, agency leaders will share their perspectives on the importance of state outdoor recreation. So we're trying to expand where people are seeing us, understanding the work that we do and how it contributes to outdoor recreation and the economy. Wanted to make you aware of that. You know that on the Wolf front, we've got, you have a major briefing that you're going to be receiving in March, bringing forward the results of our winter surveys. We've been waiting for some snow so we could get underway with our helicopter captures, starting that tomorrow. And so that's going to continue all the way through next week. We had a caller mail that dispersed from the Smack Out Pack over a year ago into an established, and it established a pack in BC. It was lethally removed by BC authorities at the end of January here, January 27th, due to wolf livestock conflicts. We're working with the BC ministry to try to get our caller back. Couple other interactions going on up in Ruby Creek. We've been doing some monitoring and hazing of one of our radio collared wolves up there, which has been hanging around some domestic dogs. One of the domestic dogs decided it was going to travel with the Ruby Pack pair. So we're trying to get the dog owner to try to get his dog, back with at home so we can avoid unnecessary interactions between those domestic dog and wolves. We've also been working, you may recall when we went over to Montana, we visited a spot where there was a compost facility that was set up by Montana Department of Transportation, and so we've been looking at trying to work with our Department of Transportation as well as other entities such as Washington Health Department, the Tri-County Health District over Northeast Washington, as well as Conservation Northwest, to try to set up a compost facility at the Sherman Creek Wildlife Area so that we could have that, try to replicate what's going on there and maybe build a pilot program that would hopefully be expanded to other areas. So there's been some good progress there. We received word from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that they completed their investigation of the wolf killed by a hunter at the Pusaten area last fall. What they told us was the evidence at the scene and statement by the subject did not refute the shooter's claim that he killed the wolf in self-defense, so we're not anticipating any further activity from a legal perspective there. And then I think I mentioned this in January that we did have a single wolf that had shown up around a ranch in Ellensburg on repeated occasions. We had our conflict specialist there, Steve Wetzel, work with the rancher to clean up some attractants around the ranch that were potentially problematic, and we haven't seen it for 3 weeks, so that looks like that worked out well. You did get a briefing from Donnie on the wildlife conflict protocols that the Wolf Advisory Group had been working on, and certainly we had some public testimony this morning that was raising concerns about that, and so I wasn't prepared to go into a lot of detail there, but I did want to just read to you a little bit about it, because there's another perspective here at least. And I wanted to reference the part that it talks about stipulations for lethal removal of wolves, and this was what was sent out to the Wolf Advisory Group members, and what was sent out by the Wolf or to the Wolf Advisory Group members. If I could figure out how to operate this thing, it'd really be great. Hang on a sec, please. One of the pieces in here is definitions, and that's where this two depredations in a calendar year, the criticism there shows up. What's the rest of the story? And it goes something like this. This is what we have under stipulations for lethal removal. Situations will be evaluated on a case-specific basis with management decisions based on pack history, size, pattern of depredations, conflict history, number of livestock killed, state-listed status of wolves, extent of proactive management measures being used on the property, and other considerations. Depending on this evaluation, the department will consider lethally removing wolves when there have been 2 to 4 separate, which means different days, depredations over a 4-month time period, including at least one confirmed kill. The 4-month time period may be extended to 6 months where depredations have been chronic or excessive as determined by the department. Prior to lethal action, the department must document that essential non-lethal measures consistent with the livestock wolf mitigation checklist have been tried but failed to resolve the conflict. Depredations are likely to continue, and there's no other evidence of intentional feeding or unnatural attraction of wolves by the livestock operator. So that puts into some context that I think some really important details about what is in, what would be considered, what the stipulations are. It's case specific. There isn't a trigger that if there's a depredation in February and another one in September that you go out and lethally remove wolves. Nothing could be further from the truth in terms of what this protocol says. I'll make sure that they include an update on that with you at the March meeting. If there's information that you would like to have prior to that, I can certainly make sure you get that. You may recall the flow chart that Donnie showed you at the January meeting, and I think that flow chart is particularly helpful in diagramming the steps and the questions that need to be addressed before you ever got to a point where you made a decision to lethally remove an animal. So.
Okay, before you go on to another subject, I wanted to just mention that when we struggled with dealing with the wedge pack problem, I think one of the takeaway lessons that I heard that we wanted to draw from that whole experience was that it is important to act fairly promptly before an individual wolf conveys the habit of preying on cattle to other members of the pack. I think that this is one of the complexities, one of the real challenges that has led the Wolf Advisory Group to come up with this complicated set of criteria and flow chart approach, because you there's nothing really automatic. Each situation is so different, but we are feeling that there are some important motivations to act promptly. Is that still the feeling within the department?
I think it's really hard to give to cookbook this. Mm-hmm. Every situation is different. Every situation needs to be evaluated separately, and I think that's really the key of the protocols. Is there's likely some cases where that would be true. There may be others where there's extenuating circumstances where you would not do that. We all vividly remember the events leading up to the wedge pack removal, and certainly don't want to repeat that. I know I never want to repeat it if possible. And we made substantial efforts to try to act more quickly than what we actually were able to do. I think when you get into trouble when you say we need to act, whether it's you need to act quickly or not, or you're going to take a wolf out if you have two depredations or three depredations or not, I think you have to really evaluate every situation carefully. You use lethal removal as the last resort, but at the same time, we know that we don't, or well, I believe that that there are situations where if wolves become habituated and then the whole pack becomes habituated, that's where you really run into really big problems. And so I know the Wolf Advisory Group has worked really hard on this, and it's unfortunate that we don't have a better coalescing around the work product. There, it was clear that those protocols could be changed at any time. I mean, so going, and I think it's obvious that from the reaction that we've received, that the March Wolf Advisory Group needs to address this and talk about the issues again and make sure that there is a full understanding of what these protocols say, because frankly, some of the representations that have been made about what it says indicate to me that there isn't a full understanding, and they may have read the one definition, but didn't read on, because there's more to it. So I will be encouraging that to occur at the Wolf Advisory Group meeting in March. Fortunately, we're generally at a time when we don't have depredation issues, so continuing the conversations will be important.
And then I also thought it would be worthwhile to respond to the public input that we got this morning about the wedge pack removal not being a success because wolves have moved into that area. That's not my understanding. We have not had predations there, but would you like to respond to that?
Well, we certainly did have some information, and I don't know that it was confirmed or not. It may have been that there's at least one animal and maybe more in the area of the wedge after the members of the pack were removed in September of 2012. I'm not aware of depredation since then. Frankly, what has been raised as a bigger concern since then in the wedge is cougar depredations. Defining success, I'm sure, is in the eye of the beholder, but we did not have any additional depredations. We had no reason to even consider any lethal removals this year. We put a lot of resources on the ground. As you well know, we have 9 new conflict specialists spread out in different places. Had a lot. We added range riders in some cases. We had an increase in that you'll hear of something on the order of 30% this past year as a result of our December. The information's still being compiled, but it's somewhere in there. We have evidence that we now have as many as 13 packs, and we had literally few problems as a result of all of those efforts. And I'm not going to say that there's probably not some luck in there too, but and good fortune. But there's been a lot of effort made to try to keep that event from happening again. Mm-hmm. So,
I would call that success for this year.
Yeah.
That meets my definition. Okay. Did you have more?
I'm afraid so.
Okay.
But it's going to speed up here, I think. I'm almost done. North of Falcons kicking off here sooner than we care to think. You've seen this, but this is a schedule of meetings, and you can see there. It's an intensive process, so I'll just leave those with you. One little piece of information that came out recently is the coho abundance forecast for 2014 in the Columbia River is up significantly, up to like 1.2 million made up of different the Columbia River late and earlies and Oregon Coastal Natural. So for whatever that's worth, last year the preseason forecast was 716,000, so up to 1.2 million, which that's good news. Just finishing up on a couple of other items that have been going on Tuesday morning, Commissioner Holzmiller and I met with Brian Shin, who's the chair of the Soton County Commission, along with Brad Johnson, who's with the Snake Recovery Board, Salmon Recovery Board in Clarkston, had a good discussion, a lot of discussion around land acquisition issues in Soton County, along with allocation issues of spring Chinook salmon in particular, the number of fish that are provided to the Snake River for that area to provide opportunity. So had a good conversation, set up some next steps on the land acquisition piece, found a real receptivity to building we're talking about putting together a memorandum of understanding between us and the county, setting up a work group so that we could go in and talk to them about what our goals are, how do they match up with the counties, make sure that before we take any additional steps, on land acquisitions, notwithstanding the 4.0 phase-in piece that we're, that everybody acknowledges we're moving forward on, that we would make sure that we're coordinated with them and that everybody understands the purpose of the acquisition should we be seeking one. So I told them that I thought this could well be a model for how we do it in other places. So, and but just, it was a very constructive conversation, so it was really gratifying to have.
Commissioner Schmitten.
Director, I recall a letter, seems like it's from the Sultan County Sportsman Association, and they were in opposition of, and I'm dredging this up, either from sale or transfer of property that department had recently got. I see that Dan is here. Maybe he could answer. But did that come up in your conversation? Because I sent a note to Holtzmiller saying that's your home area. What is, you know, what's going on?
Was that with a, do you recall that, was that with a different, was that with the 4.0 or was that with for a different parcel? Do you recall?
I don't. In fact, here it is.
Okay.
Rather than take up time now, I'll just seek
okay.
it out.
Okay, sure.
Yes, Grouse okay. Flats Wildlife Area.
That did not come up in our conversation, but I'll be happy to talk to Dan about it. We can hook up with you. Just a few other things that have been on my calendar. Did have an opportunity to meet with Eric Johnson, who's the Executive Director of the Association of Counties. Had a good conversation with him about a variety of topics. Also talked with Lisa Gramlich, who's the Dean of the College of Environment at the University of Washington. We're looking for ways how the department and the university might cooperate, collaborate on research projects. So had a good conversation with her. Obviously, a lot of meetings with legislators. There was a celebration of the 40th anniversary of the Bolt decision that Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission held out at the Squaxin Island Casino on Wednesday that I went out to for a little while. I know the governor spoke to the group later in the evening. I had left by then, but well attended by a lot of tribal members, that's for sure. Also met with Mitch Friedman from Conservation Northwest, discussed a variety of conservation issues, grizzly bears, wolves in particular. We also had went to a meeting with the Point Elliott tribes. There's nine tribes that are part of the Point Elliott Treaty and talking about hunting issues. Donuts?
I was thinking of more than donuts.
Okay.
Because that was a ridiculous
yeah.
dial.
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole pack over there.
Let the dogs out.
It's got to be more severe than donuts.
But there are a lot of issues in the whole tribal hunting arena associated with hunting on private industrial timberlands, enforcement agreements, damage, hunts, distribution of animals, distribution of harvest opportunity relative to damage hunts. So, I mean, we've got the issue up in Skagit Valley with damage where we've gone in and taken a number of animals. So just there were a lot of concerns. We had the hearing or workshop that Senator Pearson put on up in Mount Vernon that Commissioner Carpenter and I attended, and that was certainly a big topic there. Tribes were there at that particular meeting, so like to think we made some progress in our conversations. And then Sunday I leave for Vancouver, B.C. for Pacific Salmon Commission for the majority of next week. And then lastly, I just close with a really sad note. We lost our colleague Dave Bertel last Sunday to he began a battle with cancer in 2011, retired in September of just this past year, Yeah, we had a great retirement celebration with him in October, but very untimely loss, so wanted to make sure you were aware of that. So, and I just, I need to, we'll need to step away at about 11:15. We're having a bit of a gathering of anyone who knew Dave just to get together, and his memorial is likely not going to be held until the spring sometime, but a lot of people were really close to Dave in the department, and so we're just going to have an opportunity for people to get together. Our chaplain came in and will be there with us today, so I'll be stepping away here for a little bit in about an hour. So that wraps up the director's report for this meeting.
Any questions? Comments? Yes, I think it would be good for the commission to express some condolences to Dave's family. And I think we're getting a card circulated. Very sad. He will be missed. Okay, we've reached